I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the big stories of this past year was the collapse of the subprime lending industry. It's been widely reported, of course, but a big part of this story that sort of snuck under the radar is how huge infusions of foreign money into American financial firms like Morgan Stanley and Citigroup helped avoid a more catastrophic collapse. We're talking about something called sovereign wealth funds. These are investment funds owned by foreign governments, made rich by exports or oil. And the big question is, could all that foreign investment turn into foreign political influence? Bob Davis is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And Bob, who are the big players? I'm reading about the China Investment Corporation, for example.
They tend to be in either Asia, the Middle East, or Russia. So China has a couple of them that probably have about $200 billion. The Middle East is the richest by far. There's one in Abu Dhabi that has as much as $875 billion. There's one in Singapore, two in Singapore that have a total of about $200 billion, and a new one in Russia that probably has about $100 billion.
Well, let's take a look at that China fund, the China Investment Corporation, which has, as you mentioned, $200 billion in assets, and they've agreed to invest about $5 billion in Morgan Stanley. What does that do for Morgan Stanley, for example?
This gives them additional capital to either make loans or make investments. So it essentially props them up. And what they give in exchange is a stake in the company that tends to run between 5 and 10% depending on the particular investment that's been made recently.
One of the concerns about this is that all this financial investment could turn into political control. Are we at that point?
We're not at the point yet, but what makes these investments different from past investments? Remember, in the 80s, there was concern about investments from Japan. In the 70s, there were concerns about investments in the Middle East. What makes this investment different is that these are government-owned entities. So in this one, the question is, will governments seek to buy stakes in important U.S. companies as a way to exert pressure and as a way to get political power? These are governments, again, after all, not companies. And so the main function of a government is to accumulate power. However, it's more a concern than it is, an actuality at the moment.
Offer an example, though, of how that might work. How might they exert political pressure that could actually have an effect that might be counter to U.S. interests, for example?
The current investments, the sovereign wealth funds, have said that they wouldn't ask for seats on the board. Well, they don't have to do that. I mean, if a company is in big enough trouble, the sovereign wealth funds could ask for a couple of seats on the board. As with any large shareholder, well, then you have influence on the management of the company. The scarier part, which I don't think would ever happen, is let's say China had 30% of Citicorp or some big company and had a number of those kinds of stakes. Well, they could sell the stakes very quickly. That could lead to a fall in the stock market and a loss of confidence, and so on and so forth. I mean, you can kind of stretch these out into Michael Crichton-like scenarios. I don't think that's what's going to happen. It's more like with any large shareholder, management tries to pay attention to what the large shareholder would like. We've been talking about the downsides of sovereign wealth funds.
Right.
So the upsides are there's a lot of money coming into the country at a time when the country needs a lot of money. So you don't want to scare away the funds. That makes the question of what to do about them a very delicate balancing act. At the moment, what's been proposed is the International Monetary Fund is working up a code of so-called best practices that would make the funds, if they agreed, they're voluntary, these are, that would make the funds operate in a more professional fashion. So that means that they would have a board of directors is an oversight board, which would be different from the board that actually purchases the shares of companies. There might be another level where you would have professional managers. None of these get to the direct question of will the government make a purchase for their political purposes as opposed to the commercial purposes. But the hope is if they are clearly acting in a professional commercial fashion, that's the way in which they'll operate. Now, you can sketch out much more forceful kinds of responses, such as the U.S. putting a cap, say, of, I don't know, 10-20% of ownership by a sovereign wealth fund. But the concern, again, is if you do that, then the China Investment Fund will invest elsewhere.
Well, Bob Davis, thanks so much for talking to us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Bob Davis, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, talking to us about the growth of sovereign wealth funds. In Baghdad today, a bomb hidden inside a minivan exploded near the heavily guarded green zone, killing two people. But overall, violence is down dramatically in Baghdad as 2007 comes to an end. We're going to spend a few minutes now looking back at why the violence is down and also look ahead to 2008 with retired Marine Corps Captain Bing West. West makes frequent trips to Iraq as a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He's also author of No True Glory, a frontline account of the Battle of Fallujah. So, Bing West, put this into perspective for us. The American military death toll from the war is approaching 4,000. Thousands more Iraqis have died. And you write in the current issue of The Atlantic, in the fourth year of war, America teeters on the verge of defeat. So where are we after nearly 5 years of this war?
The irony of the situation is that the Sunnis have swung over to the American side, and the issue now becomes persuading the Iraqi government we put in power that they must not use the tyranny of the majority to oppress the Sunni minority. That is now the critical variable that we're teetering with, and that's a political variable, not a military factor.
So, in your view, is the surge working? Has the surge worked?
Well, the surge has certainly worked. The violence is down. But the reason the surge worked was two-sided. It worked because General Petraeus put Americans right in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Every neighborhood you go into, there are Americans. At the same time, the Sunnis, starting way out in the west, had said, we've seen enough of al-Qaeda to know they're going to kill us, and we're turning against them. So the swing of the Sunnis did not begin in Baghdad with the surge. It began far away from Baghdad and then gradually got to Baghdad. And when it got to Baghdad, there were the Americans. So you now have what are called the concerned local citizens, Sunnis, that have aligned with the Americans and are being paid by the Americans in the Sunni neighborhoods.
So then I guess the question becomes, if the surge is working, we're hearing a lot of reports of reduced violence in some areas, is it sustainable for the long term? And will it continue to be sustained after some kind of drawdown of U.S. forces, which, as you know, is being talked about?
I believe that it's sustainable as long as you have some Americans there. If you didn't, it would not be sustainable. So the issue is not the next year, because we are going to be withdrawing troops. The issue is going to be with the next president in about June of 2009. That's when the critical crunch point will come. Are we going to withdraw all the Americans, or are we going to leave a force of approximately the same size that we have in Afghanistan? And that's a decision that I don't believe you will see either party making in the next year.
You were in Iraq this past fall, and you're headed back in a couple of weeks. I'm wondering if you can tell us a story about something you saw, a particular scene that tells the story of what's going on in Iraq today.
That would be when I was in Ramadi, where they began this Sunni awakening, and the sheikh by the name of Sattar had begun this. And the al-Qaeda types had killed his brother and his father. He called together the other sheikhs and said, you know, I've had it with these guys. And the only people that are basically going to help us are these Americans. And he was the one who cut the deal. And I was there in September, and I saw him with the other sheikhs, and there must have been 50 of them. And I noticed that for the first time, the Americans were standing in the background, and it was the sheikhs who were basically taking charge. And then the great tragedy was that Sattar was killed the next week. He was set up and assassinated. And yet the movement continued even when he was gone. And that, to me, watching what the Sunni sheikhs did, was the most vivid impression I had from my last trip.
I wanted to ask you about a point that John Lee Anderson brought up in a piece that he wrote in The New Yorker about a month ago. His observations were consistent with some of what you've said about the success of the surge and the fact that the Sunnis are allying themselves with U.S. forces. But he suggested that some of the folks allying themselves with U.S. forces might be doing it for the wrong reason and sort of for temporary short-term political reasons, and that going down the road, some of these allies sort of might turn against U.S. interests. Do you share any of that concern?
There is that element in Iraq of those who have been so corroded by what they've done that I think those guys should be put in jail for the rest of their lives. Hmm. That's probably not the way it's going to work out. So I think Anderson was onto something when he said, you got to keep an eye on some of these guys. But the society itself, just like our society in Chicago or Boston or any place, if you had an active criminal element, the society pretty much knows who those people are. And we now are beginning to set up these biometric, you know, taking fingerprints and irises, et cetera, of people. You can gradually corral them if you have the will. And the reason I'm hesitating when I say that is this Ministry of Interior that runs the police in Baghdad, I think, is a snake pit. It's going to be years before that's straightened out.
We're reading now about public opinion polls in the context of the presidential campaign that tells us Americans are more focused on domestic issues, the economy, immigration, health care, than they are about Iraq. Does that surprise you at all? Does it trouble you at all?
I think it's healthy. All wars end. This war is winding down. It's time that we took a larger perspective. Any loss is a tragedy, and I've lost too many colleagues and friends in this war as in others, but this war is not major. This war is relatively a small war and will be contained, and I think 2 years from now we wouldn't be talking too much about Iraq, but we'd probably still be talking about Afghanistan.
Hmm. You see, I would ask that question because, let me sort of throw another perspective at you. You say the war is winding down, but, you know, we're still committed to the tune of, what, $1.5 billion a week or so, and we'll probably have a presence there for years to come. Is it really winding down? I mean, you're talking like it's almost over.
The question is how you measure it. I believe that it would be prudent to have a solid American force there for the foreseeable future, and by that I mean 5 or 10 years. And by a solid force, I mean between 30,000 and 50,000 troops. We've had over 30,000 troops in South Korea since 1953. We still have several thousand in Germany. We still have them in Bosnia. I believe that you can say something has wound down and at the same time have a presence there. I don't see a contradiction between the two statements.
Well, Bing West, thanks for talking to us today about Iraq.
Well, it was certainly my pleasure. Thank you.
Bing West is a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He's also a retired Marine Corps captain. You're listening to Here and Now. It was Christmas Eve, 1914, in the midst of World War I in Europe. Soldiers in the trenches of Belgium were waging the bloodiest battles of the Great War, as it was called. But something unexpected and rather wonderful happened that day. A company of British troops heard their German enemies singing Christmas carols, and the British responded with their own. The events were documented in a diary of a British soldier, and they were memorialized in song by folk singer John McCutcheon.
The Christmas truce of 1914, during the heart of the trench warfare, was a totally spontaneous but absolutely dynamic and seductive kind of an event. It began with a group of German soldiers in a lull in the battle starting to sing Christmas carols.
I was lying with my messmate on the cold and rocky ground when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent, the gas cloud rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war.
The British, who were across no man's land from them, recognized this and responded with some carols of their own, and they went back and forth like this for some time until the Germans struck up Stille Nacht, which of course is Silent Night, originally written in German but known throughout the English-speaking world as well. And the Germans and the English found themselves singing the same song in their respective languages. And according to legend, what happened next was one, supposedly a German, ventured out with a truce flag, and it was the power of this particular moment of people realizing that they were more similar than they were different that broke down the required anonymity that war presupposes. And from then on, it was sharing food and cigarettes and sweets and family pictures, and they had a soccer game.
Then one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave them hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men.
The truce lasted for just that particular night, but it was quite widespread and repeated itself in some battlefields, and the kind of battlefield discipline broke down when people would simply intentionally shoot over one another's heads. It's a very well-documented fact that they had to move troops around because they simply wouldn't fight against this particular company that was across the no man's land from them. It repeated itself several times over the years of World War I. Interestingly enough, I have found in the years since I wrote this song that the story resonates through many different conflicts. I've had people who were veterans of World War II, many, many veterans of the Vietnamese conflict, that came up to me and said, you know, I found myself in a situation not dissimilar, but sometimes it was I was separated from my company, and I met a VC regular out in the jungle, and we were about to shoot one another and realized how dumb that would be, and that we were both hungry and lost, and shared what we had and went away.
Soon daylight stole upon us, and France was France once more. With sad farewells, we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sights? It was Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they'd kept between us to exact the work of war had been crumbled and were gone forevermore.
So I think the power in the story, I didn't make the story up, I simply wrote the song, is the fact that it does break down that anonymity. And the final line of the song, in some respects, says it all. The ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame.
And on each
end, at each end of the rifle, we're the same.
We're the same.
Singer John McCutcheon telling the story of the Christmas truce from 1914. The piece was produced by Scott Gurian. Special thanks to George Balderos. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here are some of the stories we'll be covering later this week on Here and Now. In the debate about climate change, we'll consider a new approach to limit carbon emissions. The idea is, instead of capping carbon emissions at the production end, why not set up incentives at the consumer end? Do you know how much greenhouse gases were caused by that new flat-screen TV? Also, we'll talk to the people at Doctors Without Borders about the humanitarian crises of 2007 that got little attention in the U.S., from the Democratic Republic of Congo to Sri Lanka, and the Iowa caucuses in musical form. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
We're listening now to the American Christian Choir rehearsing for Christmas Eve services in Manger Square, Bethlehem. On this Christmas Eve, tourists and Christian pilgrims are flocking to the Holy Land to celebrate the birth of Jesus in his hometown of Bethlehem. Today, that hometown is located in the Palestinian territories. Visitors follow the same path that pilgrims have taken for the past 2,000 years. And now when they return home, they're carrying crosses, figurines, and other souvenirs stamped "Made in the Holy Land." In fact, Bethlehem's souvenir business stretches back thousands of years. Here and Now's Daniel Estrin sent us this audio postcard from a wood carving factory in Bethlehem that's carrying on the tradition.
The Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem is one of the oldest churches in the world. It looks like a fortress, spanning 12,000 square meters, and the walls are studded with white Jerusalem stone. Believers say the church is built on the spot where Mary gave birth to baby Jesus 2,000 years ago. It was a silent night, so the song goes, but today in Bethlehem, there's work to be done. Right behind the church is a hole-in-the-wall factory. Jacques Giacomin is bent over a wooden figurine with a chisel.
What are you making? What is that?
It is the baby Jesus. It's made for a crib. And already I made, as you see, Mary and Joseph and the manger.
Jacques is the owner of the workshop. He's completing rush orders for Christmas.
So it's a nativity scene.
Yeah, this is what we do. Mostly people here who visit Bethlehem, they need souvenir from the place where Jesus was born. So they ask mostly Mary, Joseph, and the baby, the three wise men, the animals of the crib, and all these belong to the set.
So the Bible is like your instruction book.
You read the text in the Bible and you say, oh, I have to do that. I have to do this. So the Bible is our book for art.
Jacques' family has been in Bethlehem since the days when the church's original basilica was built. His mother traces her family back to the 4th century. They were desert wanderers who heard about Jesus and became believers.
And when they converted to Christianity, they came to Bethlehem and they lived around the place where Jesus was born. And they used to live in caves, underground, and to have masses in secret in these times. All around you can see the ruins of very, very old churches, caves, and the people used these caves to live in it. And my mother's side was one of these families who lived here for 1,700 years.
In the backyard, there's a pile of wood cut from local olive trees. Jacques sets them out to dry for a few years before they're ready to be carved. Inside the shop, there are sanders, drills, saws, and chisels.
And with this machine, you can't make any mistakes.
Of course, wood, you have to be an artist.
His ancestor on his father's side was an artist too, a stone-cutting artisan from Italy. He came to the Holy Land with the Crusaders to build churches. Then, when all the churches were built, the next generation capitalized on a new business opportunity.
Because historically, look, hundreds of people visited Bethlehem, kings, everyone who believed in Jesus was his aim to visit Bethlehem. So these people start to make rosaries, beads, anything that to make profit to sell it for pilgrims.
His family has been in the souvenir business ever since. Taking a look around Jacques' workshop, you see dozens of baby Jesus figures piled up on the floor, a stack of mangers near the revolving saw.
And I think I saw an elephant somewhere here.
Of course, elephant.
You can tell this is an artist's domain, because it's a mess. There's a basket overflowing with miniature stars of Bethlehem, a wooden camel leaning against the window, and a thick layer of sawdust covers everything.
And the beauty of the olive wood, the grain of the olive wood, help us to market this. I mean, sometimes without carving, the piece itself, just cut it, it looks very nice, the olive. It's unique. Every piece is unique by its color.
The factory features stone archways and a wooden ceiling. It's 1,000 years old and used to be a stable right next to another historic manger.
Yes, we are 10 meters away from the grotto of the birth of our Lord. And this is what makes me also happy, to do carving just 10 meters away from Jesus' grotto of birth. This gives me the power and I believe in what I am carving. This is the most important thing.
Tourism nearly dried up in Bethlehem when the Intifada began 7 years ago. In 2002, when Palestinian militants took cover in the church next door, Jacques factory was taken over by Israeli soldiers in a military siege that lasted 39 days. Now, there's a concrete wall 26 feet high separating Bethlehem from neighboring Jerusalem. It's part of the barrier that Israel is building to keep away suicide bombers. It's also making it hard for Jacques to export his goods out of Bethlehem.
I mean, I don't see a future for a person, as for any Palestinians, you know, or any art to stay living, because you are a victim of a big conflict, bigger than my family, bigger than my faith, bigger than my existence. This land doesn't belong to any religion. This land is land of God, of Jesus. I am a Christian, but I don't believe that this land is only for me. It's this land belongs to any person who believes in God, even if he's Jewish, Christian, Muslim. Who believe in God, he has to live here and respect other religion in peaceful.
This year, tourism is starting to pick up. 65,000 tourists are expected to visit Bethlehem this season. That's 4 times the number that visited last year. But in the volatile political situation, Bethlehemites are still feeling desperate. Jacques considers himself luckier than others. His shop is prime real estate, and Christmas Eve is the biggest sales day of the year. And besides, he sees his craft as serving a higher purpose.
You know, sometimes I like to carve Jesus carrying the cross. Since we are Christian Palestinians, so we have to stay here to do this art, and we have to carry our own cross in this Holy Land.
Here and Now's Daniel Estrin sent us that audio postcard from Jacques Giacomin's workshop in Bethlehem. The fallout continues from the so-called Mitchell Report, which revealed an epidemic of performance-enhancing drug use in professional baseball. Among the scores of revelations was that the 7-time Cy Young Award winner Roger Clemens was allegedly a user. In the report, Clemens' former personal trainer, Brian McNamee, said he injected the all-star pitcher with steroids and human growth hormones 16 times when he played for the Toronto Blue Jays and for the New York Yankees. Clemens has vehemently denied the allegation, and now he's released a YouTube video to plead his case.
Let me be clear. The answer is no. I did not use steroids, human growth hormone, and I've never done so. I did not provide Brian McNamee with any drugs to inject into my body. Brian McNamee did not inject steroids or human growth hormones into my body either when I played in Toronto for the Blue Jays or the New York Yankees. This report is simply not true.
Simply not true. That's Roger Clemens. And we're joined by ESPN senior sports writer Tim Kurjian, who's been covering the baseball steroid scandal. And Tim, welcome.
Happy to be here.
What do you make of Clemens' denial and going public like this with a video?
Well, I'm a little confused by the whole thing. I mean, we've got all sorts of details about Clemens' steroid use, alleged steroid use, in the Mitchell report. 82 times he's mentioned. And then Clemens says, I didn't do any of that. Brian McNamee, to me, has some credibility here because Andy Pettit, another client of McNamee, basically confirmed exactly what McNamee said about him in the Mitchell report and said, yes, I did it two times. Somebody's clearly lying here, and I'm not sure what to make of this at this point.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned New York Yankees pitcher Andy Pettit, who, as you said, didn't deny the allegation. We also know that Andy Pettit was a regular partner with Clemens. They trained together. So that would seem, at least to me, to take away from Clemens' credibility.
Well, it certainly does to me also, and I'm sure some sort of conversation must have taken place there saying, Andy to Roger, hey, I have to speak about this now. I'm really interested to see Roger speak not on any sort of YouTube situation, but maybe with reporters there who get to ask him questions. Because, again, there are a lot of unanswered questions here, as there are in so many issues here involving the steroids and the Mitchell report and everything else. But the bottom line is Roger Clemens needs to speak to us, and I think he could do it in another way than the way he did it over YouTube.
Well, as you probably know, I guess my understanding is that Roger Clemens has agreed to an interview on 60 Minutes, which is going to air January 6th. Maybe that will answer some of the questions.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I think Mike Wallace is doing the interview, and he's very good at these things. He is one tough reporter, so this is good. But in the end, Roger Clemens can say whatever he wants, and, you know, somebody's going to have to prove that he's lying. And exactly how anybody is going to prove this at this point is going to be very, very difficult to prove. So I think this is going to end up being a he said situation, and you decide on your own who you want to believe. I think both guys certainly have believability here. I'm not sure which one's telling the truth.
And what about the possibility of congressional committee hearings? As of Thursday, Representative Henry Waxman of California, who's chairman of the House Oversight Committee, hasn't decided whether to call baseball players to testify. Do you think he should?
I think he should. I think if we're really going to get to the bottom of this, somebody needs to call him and have a similar situation to March 2005. But my guess is that's not going to happen. A couple people in Congress have said, look, we're not trying to punish people. We're not trying to dredge up the past here. We want to stop this from going on in the future. And this seems to be bringing up the past with Clemens, and I don't think Congress is going to go there. They're still on a fact-finding mission to make sure this problem ceases here. And going back into the past, I don't think it's going to make a whole lot of sense.
All right. Well, we'll tune into 60 Minutes on January 6th then and see where this story goes. Tim Kurjian, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Tim Kurjian, senior writer at ESPN. Coming up, a Christmas season stroll through Dickens, London. Stay with us here and now. In the week before Christmas, 1843, Charles Dickens published his classic, A Christmas Carol. Generations of people have embraced his literary vision of the holiday, partially because of the story's power, partially because it carries a century and a half of nostalgia for the good old days. But the source material for the story of Scrooge and Tiny Tim was anything but nostalgic and sentimental. That's what Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb discovered when he went for a walk on the same London streets walked by Charles Dickens and Ebenezer Scrooge and Bob Cratchit and Tiny Tim.
when Charles Dickens wrote his ghostly little book in the hope of raising the ghost of an idea. He wanted his readers to focus on the story, not where it took place. Camden Town and Cornhill, a street in the city, London's financial district, are the only two places actually mentioned in the story. They still exist, and David Parker, author of Christmas and Charles Dickens, offered to guide me from Camden Town to Cornhill, looking for the origins of the carol. The period, the 1830s and 1840s, was a time when people were taking stock of mighty changes, including the celebration of Christmas.
What happened was that there became two Christmases. The old-fashioned Christmas in the Squire's Great Hall for the entire village, and the domestic family Christmas. What Dickens really did was not invent Christmas. He was the first great writer to celebrate in print the common man's Christmas.
It was a time when people were on the move. The poorest went to live in appalling slums. The genteelly impoverished, like the family of Charles Dickens, who moved in from the country in 1822, settled in Camden Town. The Dickens' family home was here, in Bayham Street, just up the road from some almshouses, which are still standing.
Dickens didn't like being a member of a family that was hard up. He found himself compensation by familiarizing himself with the city. He was a terrific explorer. He even went to some of the more appalling slums. And at those places he felt, so he declared in later life, the attraction of repulsion.
Quiet and dark, beside him stood the phantom. They went into an obscure part of the town where Scrooge had never penetrated. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched, the people, half-naked, drunken, slipshod and ugly. Alleys and archways, like so many cesspools, disgorged their offences of smell and dirt and life upon the straggling streets, and the whole quarter reeked with crime, with filth and misery.
Young Dickens soon slid closer to the condition of those people he observed. In 1824, his father was sent to debtors' prison, and he was forced to leave school and work. Dickens was just 12 years old. Yet by 1837, he had carved out a career as a journalist and begun writing fiction. He was sufficiently successful to have bought a house in Doughty Street, midway between the Cratchits' Camden Town home and Ebenezer Scrooge's office just off Cornhill. The house is now the Charles Dickens Museum, and David Parker, former curator of the place, insisted we stop off there.
This, as you see, is Dickens's drawing room, showing how the place is likely to have been adorned at Christmas in the late 1830s.
With a pretty decent-sized tree and boughs of holly.
The tree is a bit of a liberty. They would probably not have had a tree here.
Because it wasn't done yet?
It was done, but only by royalty.
You can find Dickens's reality in London's streetscape and feel connected to the author. On the day of our walk, there was an opportunity to connect to him in the most personal way. Cedric Dickens, the author's great-grandson, was seated in the basement library of the Charles Dickens Museum, enjoying a pre-prandial of fizzy wine from New Zealand. You wouldn't question the 80-year-old's lineage. He looks like a slightly fleshier version of the Dickens we know from photos, right down to the beard and mustache. There was only one question to ask him. What was Christmas like growing up in the Dickens family?
I remember when I was about three, I suppose, the first time my grandfather, who was the second younger son of Charles Dickens, he was reading A Christmas Carol as his father had done. And he got to that heart-searing part where Tiny Tim might die and his false teeth nearly fell out. Tears were pouring down his cheek. So I know roughly how Charles Dickens had done his reading.
But when your children were growing up, did you read them?
No.
You didn't read them,
no.
Christmas?
The family never did, you see.
How did you celebrate Christmas with your own children?
Oh, goose and gravy. There's no connection to Dickens. Except latterly, we drink a thing called Smoking Bishop that comes at the end of the carol, so you do get that.
By 1843, Charles Dickens was Dickens, an author of renown and considerable financial means, but not a million miles removed from the boy who had seen how easily family fortunes could be reversed and who had explored the worst London slums. Not far from Doughty Street is a little road called Saffron Hill. David Parker took me there because the seeds of A Christmas Carol can be traced to this area.
Part of the countdown to A Christmas Carol had to do with Dickens' involvement in a ragged school, as they were called, for very poor children in slum areas.
In 1843, Dickens became involved in fundraising for a ragged school in Saffron Hill, and letters written to a fellow board member show something else was going on in the author's mind, a passionate debate about the value of charity, and it's not too difficult to see Dickens's despairing arguments turning into the thoughts of old Ebenezer.
"At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge," said the gentleman, taking up a pen, "it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comfort, sir." "Are there no prisons?" asked Scrooge. "Plenty of prisons." "The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigour, then?" said Scrooge. "Both very busy, sir." "Oh, I was afraid from what you said that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course," said Scrooge.
In Saffron Hill, our tour ended. If you were making a list of social realist literature, you might well include A Christmas Carol. From Camden Town to Cornhill, Dickens was reporting on the social reality he saw, according to David Parker.
Dickens really never stopped being a journalist, a campaigning journalist. In his fiction, he pursued the same ends that he pursued in his journalism. He wanted to make his reading public aware of the suffering of the dispossessed and make them resolve to do something about it.
And maybe, behind the sentiment and idealization of the holiday, that's what A Christmas Carol is about. If even bitter old Scrooge could be moved to help the less fortunate, not just one day a year, but every day, then surely Dickens's readers don't need to wait for a bunch of ghosts to turn up at the door to remind them to go out and relieve suffering in the world, if only a little.
God rest you, Mary.
Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb in London, and that music comes from Matty Pryor and the Carnival Band from their CD A Tapestry of Carols. Thanks to Jeremy Geit of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for his reading of A Christmas Carol. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great Christmas, and please join us again here and now.